Passage, la nouvelle série de podcasts de l'Institut français. Un échange libre et sans modérateur entre une personnalité des mondes francophones et une personnalité néerlandaise sur des thèmes qui leur sont chers.
So, I'm in Amsterdam to present Le Grand Tour, which is an anthology of contemporary European literature with 27 authors, one per member state. This is Jan Brocken for the Netherlands, and we have a bunch of fantastic European writers from all over the continent. Daniel Kehlmann for Germany, Sophie Oksanen for Finland, Mélisse de Kerangal for France, and many others. And I ask all these writers to write about a place in their own country which has a relationship which tells something about European culture or European history. Otherwise, they were completely free. There was a lens. I mean, otherwise the book would have been 1,000 pages. But otherwise, they were completely free to write about in a fiction way or in a non-fiction way. They could also have written poems. Everything was possible. And at the end of Le Grand Tour, I think you have a pretty good picture of the zeitgeist of the early 20s of the 21st century in Europe. I mean, the zeitgeist before the war in the Ukraine. I think it's going to change a lot. It's changing a lot. It's very difficult to say what's going to change. But with this book, you can see what are the perspectives for European writers. And also, I think there are two... You could divide this book in two main parts, even if there are seven chapters in this book, but there are two big parts. The first one is the memory of the totalitarian experience in Europe. I mean, I was very impressed. I was surprised and I was not surprised. I was surprised that so many writers wrote freely about these issues, I mean, about the Holocaust, about the legacy of communism in Central and Eastern Europe. The Italian writer wrote about fascism, the Portuguese one about slaves and, the tradition of slavery in Portugal. The Cypriot wrote about the invasion by the Turks in 1974. I mean, all these scares of the 20th century. So that's one of the big parts. So I was surprised and not surprised because, of course, it's so big. And the second part of the book, I would say, deals with what we could call common places of Europe. I mean, all the places that you find everywhere in Europe, like cafes, like museums, like train stations, like touristy resorts, like archaeological sites. You know, really what you find everywhere in Europe. And also about artist colonies, which has a very long tradition, of course, in Europe. I mean, Jan Brocken from the Netherlands wrote something about this, or the Danish writer. So basically, these are we can start with this, about what Le Grand Tour teaches us.
Great. I had a look at the Le Grand Tour. Very impressive. I like the idea of different people writing about Europe from their different perspective, and that comes up into some sort of canon, mm-hmm. if you want. And it's really great. And when I came here to talk to you, I thought, you know, what would I have written? And it's actually very difficult to think first. Maybe it should come straight away, but I was thinking for a while, and then in the end, I thought I would start with Berlin. Okay, I'm a Berliner, so you know it seems obvious, but I think it's not so obvious because I then lived in Italy, I lived in Belgium, in the UK, and at other places. But I think even now, after the beginning of the war, Berlin is an example of sort of hope and anxiety, sort of the worst of Europe. It's a model of the worst of Europe. I mean, the war, the Second World War, the First World War, the Holocaust, and then the separation, the Teilung, you know, the Berlin Wall and so on, the Cold War. So the Berlin is a symbol for all these things, but then it's also a symbol for what can happen. The wall could come down, something unbelievable. I was there in the beginning of the day, the 9th of November, 1989, if someone had said to me in the evening, the wall is gone, I would have said, you know, you're a lunatic. So things can happen. And then Germany actually managed a relatively soft landing, so to say, as a European power. Maybe it's under discussion now with the war, but I think it shows that positive things can happen out of something terrible. And if I had to take one more specific place, actually, I live close, and my street is actually the only street in Berlin which is still divided by the wall, because there's the Wall Museum, Bergstraße. And so I often go, especially during the corona times, for a walk along the former wall strip. It's now very green and trees and grass, and then there is a bit of the wall, and I think that's an amazing place to remember sort of angst and hope. So sort of that's my opening shot, so to say.
I lived 5 years in Berlin at the end of the last decade, and I mean, I think the first year of my stay in Berlin, I was so impressed because I could feel history everywhere. Also because the city there's this very specific policy in Berlin, I mean, to show the historical places. I mean, this is where someone lived, and about the Second World War, about the GDR, about everything. Even if you not Andre, but you decided to destroy the big GDR palace to build the
Palace de République.
Genau, Palace de République. I was there. I mean, it was still there when I arrived, and then they destroyed it, and then they started to build again the castle, yeah. Hohenzollern Castle, which is a strange thing.
Very strange.
But I was very impressed, in fact, by this, because, I mean, I love history, and I was so sensitive to all of this. And this is something which is interesting for Europe, because we have this, I mean, the memory of the past is so huge and so terrible, but on a certain way, Berlin managed to transform this as a positive thing. Which is very strange, because I don't know many cities in Europe where they manage to do the same, to have this Erinnerungskultur, this memory, this culture of memories, and to manage to transform it in a sort of a positive way. And I mean, Berlin is full of ghosts, but it's not like Vienna or Warsaw or Budapest, where you can feel there is a very melancholic thing in other central European cities. And you don't have this melancholic thing in Berlin. There is sometimes on a November day and November Sundays. I mean, it's Berlin can also be pretty depressing. Mm. But otherwise, you have this energy that you don't feel in so many European cities.
Mm. Well, I was thinking about it recently in the course of the war in Ukraine, and when we talked about people in Russia who would oppose the war, and where to find them, and whether it would be possible. And now people don't think it's possible to bring down the Putin regime. And I say to them, look, I know things can happen. They can happen very quickly. Maybe it will take decades, but maybe it will be very quicker, or it will be quicker than you think. And you have to have that sort of hope that things can happen. And if you don't have that, and I have that hope, because if basically you could, or Nazi Germany could become a nice Germany, then anything is possible. Then also Putin's Russia will in good time become a good neighbor and friend again, maybe. Now people probably will tell you, what is this guy? Is he, you know, is not with Ukraine. No, that's not the case. But we also want to have a Russia to be a friend again at some point. Not now, of course, but if Nazi Germany could become a friend, the former Putin of Russia will become a friend too in the future. And I think that's the story for me of Berlin in that sense. And then we also want to talk about football. And in fact, 2006, the Football World Cup in Germany was a very important event, much more important for Germany than for football, because it showed for the Germans and for the world that the Germans can be fun and that they can be welcoming and they can be good friends and they can have a party.
I was in Berlin at that time, and I have to say that was one of my best football and experience as a human being, I have to say. I mean, the atmosphere was so friendly, and the Germans were so surprised to be so cool, in fact, and to be loved by everyone, and they organized it so well. But especially the atmosphere was amazingly friendly. And then I went to Russia for the last World Cup. Because I wrote a lot about football, and Le Monde sent me, had a column every 2-3 days. And the atmosphere was very different in Russia. But Putin, who was clever at the time, didn't appear as the super dictator. I mean, he just showed up at the first game, and then he completely disappeared. And as if Russia was a kind of normal country. And, I mean, I had been in Russia before, and the atmosphere was very different in the sense that you couldn't see so many police. And you had, I mean, if you didn't know what was the regime like in Russia, you could say it was a normal democracy. People were friendly. I mean, the police were friendly. Even people in the museums, working in the museum, were friendly. Well, it is well notorious that people in the museums in Russia are terrible. They never smile, like in the communist times. And but the atmosphere was very different. You could feel, I mean, lots of people told me, be careful with your phones, and you should have a Russian phone, and even if it looks normal, it's not normal. Germany was completely different in 2006. And what you say is very... It's true that what happened in Germany, even there are lots of things to say about German policy toward Russia the last 15 years, and about Merkel, for instance. But it's true that the evolution of Germany is... It's not only interesting, it's also a kind of a model, how it worked on its history. And I think this is what didn't happen in Russia. There was, education, and there was no culture of memories. I mean, they didn't look at Stalinism, they didn't look at what happened under Lenin and everything. The worst things of the Gulag and even the German Soviet alliance in between 39 and 41. I mean, this never happened, and all the NGOs like Memorials would try to work to dig on Russian history, couldn't work, and now they're closed. So I think this is the main difference. For me, Russia today is a bit like Germany during the interwar period. I mean, the evolution, basically, the Yeltsin years were kind of funny and creative, but it was also a big mess, a bit like the Weimar Republic in a certain way. And the Russians, lots of Russians, the feeling of humiliation, like the Germans in the 20s, early 30s. And then Putin, I don't like this comparison, is Putin a new Hitler and this kind of thing. But you have this evolution, in fact, that he worked on this idea of humiliation. And so I hope what you're telling Andre is true, but it will take long, long time, because I worked a lot about German memories. I wrote, for instance, the script of this movie, Der Staat gegen Fritz Bauer. And although the book about Mengele is also a book about a reflection about German memory. I mean, it took something like 30, 40 years, in fact, for Germans to really work on its history. So if we're optimistic, maybe in 2060, Russia will be a good friend of of the West, if it's not 60 or 70 degrees outside.
Well, it's still, I think, it's still good to know that things can happen. But it's interesting what you say about the interwar years, which is also, creating a certain level of anxiety because we know what happened at the end of the interwar years. What concerns me, and of course we wanted to talk about also more fun things, is do we as humans need to reinvent everything again? Do we thought we figured it out in a way, you know, we had that thing with war, it's over. I mean, we don't need that anymore. We do other things, technology and so on. And we even talk about Europe. We even set up conferences and reflection groups to figure out what is the purpose of Europe just a few years ago, because we thought we lost it. We lost the purpose of Europe. And now we're back to something quite basic. It's a peace and cooperation. We are happy only with that basic notion. We don't even wonder about any. So, and I just wonder, do we need to go through another cycle? And now it's up to you to turn this into a positive thing.
Thing is, basically what we can see, maybe Germany is a bit different. But otherwise, in every European country or Western country, society is divided in two camps. The camps which is so-called populist and so on perceive Europe as an enemy or adversary. And I think this is the main challenge. It's to bring Europe to these people, to show that Europe is not something for what they call elite or people who are on the good side of the globalization gate. But it's something which is for everyone. Maybe there will still be a bunch of nationalists and will never be interested by this. But I think that half of this population, I mean, a good part can be convinced. And I think this is our main challenge. And the EU is too associated with the people who are on the good side of the gate. And because I don't know if it was a factor of liberal globalization or if it was just something which accompanied this globalization. But because we lack, there is a lack of cultural aspects of the EU. Mm. Something, because what's the story tell us, I mean, the last 10 years? There is a huge problem of identity. Because of globalization, lots of people felt threatened. Mm-hmm. And Europe was not a friend for these people. They didn't bring something, in fact, to give them a kind of insurance about their identity. On the other end, it was perceived as a catalyst for more identity change. And I think this is one of the big, big, big issue. I don't know if it's positive, but I think it's an interesting perspective. If we can try to build a bridge between these two parts of the populations, otherwise we're gonna be more and more divided, and something will happen. I mean, we can't function as societies like in the U.S. This is a catastrophe. What's going on in the U.S. Biden or not Biden, Trump or not Trump, and I think this should be one of the main goals of the EU. Is it positive enough for you, Andre?
Well, I mean, I think of I'm thinking, and when we have 2 minutes, I was told, or we were told, I think there are so many books and stories out there which are negative. Mm-hmm. So when I wrote a book about Europe, my publishing house said, look at this wall. This wall is full of books about how bad Europe is. And I said, exactly, that's why I want to write a positive book, mm-hmm. simply because you need to put another story in.
You know what we should do? I mean, we are the 9th of May, so the mm-hmm. Day of Europe. We should organize, I don't know, like a continental buffet next year for everyone. And just to share, because, I mean, food is a huge part of European identities. Mm. And it's very friendly and it's very open to... And so if we could organize, I don't know, like a huge restaurant all over Europe, the next 9th of May, just to show, I mean, just to bring Europe to all these people who don't feel concerned or feel threatened by Europe. That would be just a little thing, but it would be funny.
Well, I think there's lots of little things, like, for example, coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
Coffee is another thing. I mean, it unites Europe. I call it sort of the secret social network of Europe are the coffee places. But also singing songs, even the Eurovision Song Contest, in a way. I see it as a kind
Champions
League.
Instead of Gazprom, we could have some EU institutions sponsoring the Champions League. It would be much better than not sponsoring, but at least you could see a European flag, that it's part of European identity, and it's part of European identity, the Champions League. So a banquet, a huge European banquet we could organize next year.
That sounds like a good idea.
It's
Maybe I would pick up on the question of identity. One thing on my grand tour of Europe, so my life in Europe, was I lived in Switzerland for a while. And when I lived there, I thought, maybe I look into the history of Switzerland. And it's actually very interesting, because it is, in a way, in a small way, the history of Europe, but over 800 years. And at that point, I thought, maybe we're expecting a lot from Europe to do a lot of things in a very short time. We have now the history of a peaceful European Union for like 75 years or 72 years. But Switzerland needed around 800 years to come to the current imperfect form it is. It's still not perfect. You know, there are lots of faults and so on. They're still working on it. But it took a long time. I call it die Schweizer Langeweile. It's also a little bit boring, but it took a long time. So in German, it's the same word, strangely enough, only written in a different way. Langeweile or Langeweile. The story of Switzerland is interesting in a sense that it can happen, it will happen, but it may take longer than we think, and it will take trouble, conflict, but working out the conflict. And I think, in a way, that's for me the identity of the new Europe. The new Europe is working on itself in a way, like a developing country, in a positive sense. It's constantly developing. It's not giving up. I think that's, for me, a positive vision of Europe as a developing country.
Yeah, it's a dynamic process, that's for sure. You speak about Switzerland, I like thinking about the Kaunka, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. I have a kind of nostalgia for this empire. Especially I have the nostalgia of this very cosmopolitan ensemble. People speaking four or five languages, traveling easily under a kind of a common umbrella. Okay, it was an empire with an emperor, but somehow it worked pretty well. And everyone could speak its own language and were presented in the parliament at the end, and with tolerance for many religions, many nationalities. And I think that was a big, big mistake to destroy this ensemble. All the catastrophe came from Central Eastern Europe, and it's still coming. So, yeah, something between... I think the Austro-Hungarian Empire was a bit more exciting than Switzerland, at least in my idea. Even if I really like Switzerland somehow, because it's an interesting model, but people don't really mingle. I mean, the French are on their side, the Germans on their side, the Italians on their side, but it's very small, so of course people meet. But yeah, something in between. What was interesting with, it's also the case with Switzerland. I mean, they have very strong symbols. The flag, the anthem, the landscapes, chocolates, the clocks, everything. It's true. This is how it works.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to have very strong symbols. I mean, if we had to give some symbols of contemporary Europe, what would it be? Difficult. That's the main difference with Switzerland. I'm not even talking about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which had so many symbols and also a religious story. And of course, we can't build a European empire like this. But Switzerland works. I mean, it's like it's a brand everywhere in the world. I mean, for the good and for the worst. I mean, you have the banks also, you have everything. And I think this is something what Europe should develop, strong symbols. I mean, when you think about Europe, okay, you think about all of this. And but it's an interesting perspective.
Well, now I give you one final thought on that, on the symbols. It is a bit provocative. What about bureaucracy? Could that be a symbol of Europe? You might, people say this is terrible, and I picked that up because it is so terrible. Because people say, "My Europe is great, but there's a bureaucracy." And I looked at this and I thought, maybe not, maybe not. And that's why I call it the discreet charm of the bureaucracy. Because let's say, in the old days, Europe's sport was war. And then they decided to give it up, and they created a bureaucracy. Robert Schuman was a bureaucrat. They created a bureaucracy to fight out their wars through regulations. So now we have a bureaucracy which is fighting every day about paragraphs and this and that and trade things. And I think it's quite a civilized way of sorting stuff out. If it works, I mean, so far.
We go back to the Austrian-Hungarian Empire,
exactly,
which has a very strong bureaucracy also, and some of the Musil wrote about this, or Kafka was part of it somehow.
But let's not come out of this podcast and saying the symbol of Europe is the bureaucracy. Then you know,
maybe we can find something more sexy. for the next podcast, we can find something more attractive than bureaucracy, even if it's very civil, it's very urban way of treating, fine compromise. But yeah.
If you would have one word to describe Europe according to you, what would it be?
It was one word. I think it's beauty.
A river.